Hello, Peter C. Hine here. This is just a pre-warning and an apology that the sound quality in this podcast isn't quite up to the standard that we usually go for. That's just due to the technical challenges of talking to someone 4,000 miles away on a shoestring budget. But if you can overlook the issues with the audio quality, you'll hear that our guest is as interesting, eloquent, and entertaining as his reputation would suggest. And if you can't overlook it, then just use this as an hour of practice for your EVP scrying. Either way, enjoy. Welcome to Vase, a podcast about weird stuff. I'm Peter C. Hine, and with me as ever is my partner in Vase, Stephen James Buckley.
Hi everyone, and we actually have a very special guest with us today. He's someone we've mentioned in a number of Vase episodes, notably for his book, The Secret Cipher of the Euphonauts, which was a hugely important piece of work in bringing together the two seemingly disparate worlds of ufology and magic. We've been utterly fascinated by his work since first seeing him on Hellier earlier this year, and we're extremely honoured to have him talking with us today. It is, of course, all the way from Atlanta, Georgia, Dr. Alan Greenfield. Hello, Alan.
Hi. I flew over just for your program. Yeah. I didn't stop to see Stonehenge or any of that stuff. And I was out on the moors, you know, right around where you are. Really, like the Everglades, it's really, really, really bushy, you know.
Yes.
I keep seeing the Hound of the Baskervilles chasing me and all of that. I would have thought my sex magic book, which is different from all the others, would be the book people would talk about. But no, it's the complete secret cipher of the Euphonauts, which sold well when, you know, the original edition sold out and cost the publisher his life. Oh, shouldn't say that, my current publisher. Tossed me off the list, but I don't think so.
Well, there's more than just the secret cipher, isn't there? And Hellier, because I've been doing just some research into your career, and you've been an occultist and a ufologist for over 60 years now. Is that right? You were part of the
getting there. I was actually more like 100 years, but I forget. Something wrong. Where is my brain? Oh, excuse me. Let me put my brain. Oh,
because you were so young when you started. You were part of the teen ufologist movement.
Yeah, exactly.
With you had Tim Beckley, Gene Steinberg, Rick Hilberg, and you were in doing that, in starting so young, you had the opportunity to rub shoulders with the original first generation, like Gray Barker, Jim Moseley, John Keel, Ray Palmer, Richard Shaver. Through all that, you co-founded the longest running UFO convention, the National UFO Conference. You won the UFCO Ufologist of the Year award twice. And on the occult side, your adventures as a magician led you to climb the ranks in the OTO. During your two-decade membership, you were ordained a bishop until you left in around 2006. And then you became instrumental in the global spread of the worldwide Free Illuminist movement. The first book that you wrote, The Secret Cipher of the Euphonauts, together with its sequel, has become a classic and foundational text in the exploration of the crossover between magic and the occult. And as Buckley just said, we'll talk about that in detail later. You've written many other books, including Sources and Sorcerers, The Grail Within, The Modern Roots of Magic, all of which grace my bookshelves. You've written countless articles, appeared in TV shows such as Ancient Aliens, Brad Meltzer's Decoded, and more recently, the incredible Helia, which we've talked about on the show before, which has caused a massive resurgence in the popularity of your work and allowed you to take your rightful place as the elder statesman of high weirdness. And you continue to release books, and you continue to inform and educate, entertain on Twitter, and as a guest on many occult podcasts, which is what brings you here tonight.
Do you think? Because you invited me, and I'm a media whore. I'll go wherever I'm invited.
So is that can that be correct? 60 years you've been doing this for?
I got into this in 1960, so do the math.
Wow. Yeah. So what occurs to me is that what I've just said about you there, that barely even scratches the surface. I mean, this resonates.
Where did that come from? That sounds like my own self-hype as opposed to the Wikipedia piece, which is...
Oh, the Wikipedia is awful. Don't look Helen up on Wikipedia.
That is, you know, it says that I plagiarized the book.
Yeah,
I think the base, that was removed by my publisher.
Yeah.
And they took it back out because there are a lot of, I suspect, OTO people who go in there and trash me, including my, dating back to my OTO days, my troll who follows me around and always, without reading them, I suspect, gives every book that I've ever done a really bad review and then goes on these sites. He suffers from some kind of illness.
That resume is absolutely incredible. I mean, it's probably more astonishing than any of the phenomena that we're going to discuss tonight. I mean, it does really seem like you've lived a sort of a weird, wonderful, and many varied life over the years.
I was a Boy Scout, too.
We'll get into that later. That weird stuff, that Masonic cult.
Well, it's pretty Masonic, you know. Yeah. I was in the B'nai B'rith Youth Organization, and I understand they had a separate one for boys and girls in those days. It was called AZA, Alephabetic Aleph. And the opening was the same opening, essentially, that you get in a Masonic Lodge or in the OTO. I'm betraying the secret.
You heard it here first.
Probably not. You know?
No.
They say, don't reveal your degree to anybody, but they make these beautiful certificates that all the proud members put up on their walls. Now my friend Cal Roger has them in a closet somewhere, probably. You know? Burn them upon my demise.
Going back to your childhood then, as a Boy Scout, what did you get into first? Was it UFOs or was it the occult?
You know, people ask me that, and I think it is both at the same time. Okay. It may be somewhat Freudian, but while I was going through puberty, I joined NICAP, National Investigation Committee on Aerial Phenomena, and the Mystic Arts Book Society, which was then publishing every book that on the occult that wasn't nailed down by copyright, and the Science Fiction Book Club, and a couple of others. And I was already reading science fiction. I was already reading Philip K. Dick. I mean, I think the first one I read, I bought it at Bill Starkenstein's Bookateria, along with a lot of copies of amazing stories from the 1940s.
Excellent.
I've still got one edition of that. Most of that I gave to an acquaintance of mine. I'll get into that later. Because I didn't really know him that well. We can't find him anywhere but in Greenfield's book. Well, you couldn't find me in the years that I was because everybody in my affinity group had a non de guerre, because some of our Canadian comrades got put in the slammer, probably are still there, the Mounties, as they call it, found in their garlic fertilizer and ammonia, which I understand from the, what was it called, the Anarchist Cookbook, which is neither anarchist nor a cookbook, can make an explosive. But it's also in every garage.
Yeah.
in the known universe, all the way to, you know, the Big Bang. It's just standard stuff, but that was enough to put them behind bars, like for 20 years. So we all took names. And so if you want to look up me, you would be looking up Spider Rainbow. And if you want to look, and if you want to look up my den squeeze, you would be looking up Lacey Rainbow or Ash Guy. Or, I mean, some of them I knew they're, you know, they're, well, I hesitate to call it a Christian name because they just, definitely there were no Christians among them, but so, never mind. The point is, you're not going to find any of those people on the internet, or we did something wrong. I mean, but
and that's
a
like
a long time ago, and we're none of us, well, most of us are still alive, and that's it. It was a short period of time.
Because with Terry Rist, he presumably was using that name for a few years.
I think he just adapted that as a thing because he's Terry R. Rist. And we never took it to be a real name, but it's impolite to ask in that kind of circle. And he was only there for a year. We did that for 15 years. Yeah, we got too old to run from the police.
What was it?
Not the police, the evil ones. The Black Lodge. We ran from the Black Lodge.
What was it about him that made you want to interview him? Because there's an interview in both parts of the Complete Cypher with Terry Rist.
They're separate interviews. They were done about a month apart, I think.
Yeah. What was it that intrigued you so much about him that you thought you would interview him for your book?
Well, I just interviewed another person. I am Carrie Thornley.
Yeah.
And that went really well, although I knew him from anarchist circles, but I invited him to Euless Lodge number 10, OTO Incorporated. And unfortunately, I was not aware of his more conspiratorial ideas. I only knew him through anarchism and the Discordian stuff. But he was acting like he had just walked into the gates of hell, and he proceeded to tell me. Anyway, so that went really well. In fact, somebody asked to borrow the tapes, and I later saw it as a book somewhere.
So we covered a bit in the episodes 4 and 5 of Vase, the ultra-terrestrial hypothesis. And in that episode, we talked about how the cipher was developed, but we didn't discuss, because we didn't know, what or how you came upon the cipher, which was already an established occult technology, and how you came upon the idea to apply that to your other interest, which was ufology.
That is why, where is my voice? Talking like an old man now. Well, guys, I was singing before the program, and I'm singing to myself. So don't think this is my voice. It's a parody of my voice. But if I sing, what was the question?
So how did you sort of come across the idea of using, or how did you come up with the idea of using the cipher, which was a known sort of occult technology? How did you come up with applying that to your other interest, which is the UFO thing? And then how did you realize that you could get such interesting results?
The cipher itself, I'm sure you know, was, well, maybe not exactly, was found on a magical retreat by members of the British, one of the many incarnations of the AA. So Jim Lees and Carol Smith and I think Jake Stratton Kent, who is very ill right now, and who, interestingly enough, is cited as a source on Wikipedia for saying that I was a plagiarist. And actually, he said, I liked your book. I said, what's your problem? He said, my problem is with American occultists who have taken up the cipher and not given me credit, along with Carol Smith and Jim Lees. And I said, well, I have. But I didn't get it directly. I got it from, and this is where the story gets complex, there was is a tiny organization called the Kabbalistic Alchemist Church, the QBLH. And it was originally headed by a real name, W.W. Webb. William Wallace Webb, who started it, interestingly enough, when he was living, he and his wife were living in the Mojave Desert, not that far from where Adamski lived and where Jack Parsons did his mischief. And QBLH was the first, as far as I know, first American organization that took an interest in the cipher. My second wife's second husband was a guy from Buffalo, New York, who had been on very, he was a QBLH person, but he edited a magazine called Thelema, which DOTO eventually made him stop publishing because that name belongs to them, according to the Supreme Court of the United States, Inc. So he was, I often say he was too good for this world. He eventually killed himself. But anyway, he came south at some point after having developed the Lexicon program, the first program that did things that I don't think any of the others that still exist do. But it was like he developed it on a mainframe where he was working. Well, he's dead too, so I could say, at the Ford Motor Company. So it was... He, as a matter of fact, he told me when I was living in the QBLH house in the 1990s, back in the previous century, he said, it's probably still running on their computer in the background. And but in any case, he was able to convince it enough to put it on a floppy disk, which, you know, I have nothing to play a floppy disk on anymore. And I don't know anybody that has a working version of the Lexicon program. He showed it to me as an occult cipher and showed me some copies of the British Journal of Ceremonial Magic, which was Lees and Associates' publication. And it was mostly about the discovery of the cipher and working with it for occult reasons. So anyway, so Prater Lamed, as he was then, got involved with and eventually married my second wife, who also had one of those names. She was in the group. Anyway, you would think that we would be hostile to one another, but actually we hit it off better than I did with her. So, I mean, he was in occult circles, but he was also open to all this other stuff, which is not usually true. You know, it's usually one-hit wonders for any interest. And that's one of the great frustrations in my life, because I said, when I was 13 or 14, I got involved with all this stuff. Did my first tarot reading at 15. So that was a long time ago. I probably, unless some Romani people have been practicing longer than that, I've probably been a tarot reader longer than anybody else in Norto Americano.
Amazing.
North America. Yeah, probably just by default. But I, you know, first reading was for my mother. So it was presented to me as an occult cipher, and he gave me a copy of Lexicon. So I took it because, you know, if you're president, you have respect for them to do. And he said, well, try it. So he had it against the Book of the Law, Liberal, the Legis. So I tried it on a few words and names and things that actually don't work very well. And I said, okay, well, I'll get into this. At some point, since it was on a disk that sat next to my computer, my desk is always a junkyard filled with important things. And, but never, and I know where they are mostly, but nobody else could ever do that. Yeah, my publisher came to visit with his girlfriend a few weeks ago. And I loaded him up with a lot of the stuff that I said, look, it's going to be in boxes forever. You're my literary executor, so take it and use it, or, you know, whatever you're going to do with it. Just if you find any personal things, please return them to me. But and he lives almost as far away as you are physically from me.
Right.
In California,
that's
3,000 miles.
Is that that's Olav Phillips? Is it from Paranoia?
Well, he's not from Paranoia anymore.
Okay.
In Sacramento, they also were very nice to me. They were my publisher for a while, but he's migrated my stuff. And maybe I shouldn't say this. I don't know if I'm talking out of school, because Olav, I wouldn't be alive if it weren't for Olav. I was ill 2 years ago with, well, we'll never know what, but I was in heat. I got dehydrated and I ignored it because I've never been sick in my life. And Olav provided me with, I mean, because I just couldn't go anywhere doing it. So he provided me with bottles of Evian and water and, you know, get me alive, and Jell-O, because there's always room for Jell-O.
Well, I'll link to Olaf's Twitter, because I follow him on Twitter, and that's good. And I'll link to what's his publishing press called now, the one that your books are out on.
Oh gosh, it's new. So I'm originally it was under Paranoid Press, but in talking back and forth with him, he, like me, although, you know, we're not exactly the same politically, are appalled at what's happened with the conspiracy community. Yeah. I mean, it's become entirely a fascist front.
Yeah, it's horrible.
Q and all that bullshit.
Yeah.
So I think he's de-emphasized that, and I don't know if conspiracy press even exists as such anymore. It's he does it under the rubric of the Celestial Lodge of Sirius, Inc., because it is a press. But, I mean, my original publisher was Illuminate Press, which was probably the grandfather of a lot of conspiracy theories. But Ron Bonds, who was the main guy there before the Black Lodge, often. I don't know. I hesitate to mention any of this stuff. I mean, the book that we're working on now, we don't have a title yet, but it's on the Black Lodge, because nobody's done a book on that for, what, 80 years, something like that, because it's a forbidden subject, even in occult circles. I worry, because it will unavoidably go into some stuff that is related to conspiracy stuff, and I don't want to feed that demon. I mean, because I know...
Yeah.
What the people that talk about the reptilians who are secretly among us, I know what they're really talking about, because I'm Jewish.
Yeah, yeah.
I know what reptiles look like. And that guy, I think he's English, right?
Or is it David Icke.
Yeah.
He just substitutes the word reptilian. And you know, the protocols of the learned reptiles or something.
Yeah.
I think he's even admitted it. I think he's even actually pretty much admitted, yeah, I mean Jewish people, which is awful, really.
Well, at least he's, you know, I'd rather somebody like that be out of the closet than using that substitute term, because not everybody that follows his ideas, because his ideas are kind of the same as Graham Hancock's. Oh, gosh, I'm getting too far. Did I hear a cat?
No, it was my my partner bringing me a cup of coffee, because she's wonderful.
You live with a cat? Okay. Hey, I got no room to talk. It's convincing. Make her come on Kenmore. I'm going to be sure you're actually having an affair with her.
I don't like where this is going, Alan.
Okay, I get interested in all this stuff. My pubic hair grew in, so think about that. Think about all the years of psychotherapy. But it's not important. What's important is that, having tried Lexicon and already being deep into the UFO stuff, I thought, well, I'm not getting anywhere with the occult stuff. And it really, you know, once the, oh, I'm going to say cat is out of the bag. Once the cat is out of the bag, never put a cat in a bag. They actually do freeze up if you put them in a bag. But that's not what the subject of this conversation is, I don't think. Jesus H. Christ and the seven dwarfs. I'm really deep in the shit now. Buy my books. Please, people. I need all the help I can get. Okay. So I tried it on a couple of the weird words or names that had sprung up in mythology and still spring up, although they're not as common now because the classical contactee cases aren't as common. Usually they don't have names now. They just have got you and stick something up your dirty air. I think for kicks, actually, I think that's what that's all about. But what do I know? Some people like it and some people don't like it. Different strokes.
I'm currently reading Communion by Whitley Strieber, and it is, I find it a very disturbing book. Like, it's quite horrific, really, isn't it? And I wondered, what were your thoughts on it? Do you think he's the real deal, Strieber, or do you think?
Oh, yeah, I think that, you know, it's like the little things I get, that I'm a plagiarist, that I'm live a dual life or transgender. I don't do anything. I mean, my life is as odd as it gets, so I don't have to do any inventing. But he had the reputation as a good horror writer. He could have continued to do that, but Stephen King hasn't said, well, the aliens actually told me all this. It diminished his stature in, you know, where he at his bread and butter issues. So he had no motive. He could have been a silent contactee. Instead, he chose to make it rather public. And it took off because he also had street cred. That term familiar to people in Northern England.
Yeah, even. we don't have much of it, but we're familiar with the term.
We know.
In fact, if I give a talk in person, and half the audience doesn't walk out, I feel like a failure.
I think one of the things with Communion is it's not a particularly entertaining book. And you'd have thought if he was writing a piece of fiction, he's a good fiction writer, he would have made it more entertaining. It's not entertaining. It's horrible. It's really disturbing.
He got sent to a very common occurrence in the during the satanic panic of the 1980s. There was a lot of hypnosis stuff and too much suggestion from the hypnotists. And, the rumors, I mean, sent those three guys to prison. Well, they were sentenced to die, and they eventually was commuted to life in prison. And now they're out because apparently they didn't do anything.
With Strieber, it's Damien, like,
whatever his name is.
Jamie Eccles, yeah. I mean, with Strieber, I mean, that thing about the probing and everything has become very much a trope of the nuts and bolts theorists. But his experience itself is probably much closer to something more out of fairy lore or something like that. You know, the way that it's not a stereotypical nuts and bolts encounter as you would see them in the X-Files or the things that followed in the 90s?
Everything, this is what I'm convinced of. First of all, I think a lot of these people have never done a real field investigation. that's why I lionized Hellier so much, not because it was gave me an opportunity to talk it. Well, I think it was like 4 hours of stuff, and that's true with any TV program, but they did a fair cut. In other words, what they kept condenses my somewhat verbose verbiage without cutting into, you know, what I was saying. That was really good. And some of the things that have been said about that, like the flashing clock, I didn't even see that clock until after the interview. And somebody disconnected the clock. You know.
Hellier is the reason we're here. I mean, we Hellier is what made us start doing Vase, you know, and introduced us to your work. So we'd like to think Hellier itself is a call to initiation. You know, it's bringing people into this area and making people like us. I think we're almost like part of the post-Hellier effect, you know?
And I don't think that it gets people interested. I think that it is itself an initiation. I mean, I've been through a lot of formal initiations, it's in quotes, but I think people who watch Hellier Season 1 and Hellier Season 2, and I hope eventually there's a Season 3, actually, although the Newkirks have a podcast now, which is on YouTube, so you can see them.
It's good.
And just like your program will be in the future, because I am a physicist, you know. No, I'm not a physicist. Physics is some kind of cinema. I am a psychic, that's a friend, and I see a future for that. It's coming soon to a theater or drive-in near you. You can find a drive-in. There is one in it. Where was I?
You were talking about the field work or lack thereof.
Yes. If you haven't done in-depth field work, and that does not include going to somebody's door, annoying them, and having a checklist of predetermined questions. It wasn't the apparent size of a basketball. Yeah. I mean, if you have these predetermined questions and probably have no real experience as a field investigator, you're never going to find anything that way. One time, Jim Mosley and I and the head of a spinoff from whatever we were calling the Atlanta UFO group at that time, in a little town just south of Atlanta, probably in Atlanta now because the city spreads in all four directions. But it was pretty much a country town at that time. Anyway, he had the Preternatural Variables Investigation Agency, PETA. And he said, look, there's a UFO landing area here in this wooded area. And there really was an almost impenetrable wooded area. I've never seen anything that thick that actually keeps you out. The only other place in the world that I've ever seen that was in Tahiti. So Mosley was in town. His dad lived here. We decided to go down and interview some of the local witnesses that this, you know, local guy had done. So there were three of us. And we went door to door, like a door to door salesman. And we said, so have you seen the flying objects? And at some point I had one of my epiphanies, a minor one, but an important one. I said, you know, we're all dressed, and this was in the winter, in our London Fog raincoats and wearing hats, which are not fashionable, but we were all doing it because we were weird people. And I said, so what they're going to remember is some guy came to my door and there was three of them, three guys, and they were dressed in black and they asked me about flying saucers. And they seemed disappointed when I said I hadn't seen one, and I saw them go over toward my neighbor's house. But there the legend began.
So you're the original man in black.
No, I'm not. I mean, the cases are found in folklore going back to antiquity. So it's not me, it's not the CIA, and it isn't even Gray Barker. Not like he wouldn't, but he didn't. I know what he did, because he told me what he did.
So we did a couple of episodes, as we've already mentioned, about the ultra-terrestrial hypothesis. And we mentioned in those episodes Gray Barker and Jim Moseley. And we made them out, probably unfairly, but we made them out to be basically charlatans. But we were new to the subject. And now that we're talking to someone who was actually there, we'd like to give you a chance, if you'd like, to set the record straight in the matter.
God love you for giving me that opportunity. Did Jim and Gray get very drunk and stoned together and do a certain amount of hoaxing? Yes. Were they serious about ufology? Absolutely. Jim more than Gray, because Gray lived in rural West Virginia, and that's heart of Appalachia. What used to be coal country when coal was important to the Democratic Party. And Gray also had a degree in English literature and was interested in folklore. So he knew the folkloric background to all this stuff. And people who seemed pompous to them, I mean, Jim Moseley was a Princeton man. Gray, I don't know which college he went to, but he was, you know, he was degree. Most of these people were not. And some of them were very pompous, and they were all into ye olde ETH. A right old theory it was. So they would take them down a notch. Something tells me you've learned a lot of this stuff in the period since you did that program. So I don't want to be unfair to you. You know, as you say, you were new at this and you were reading the stuff that if you read, I was recently reading a couple of articles about some of the scientists who were involved in the CIA program to use Mind Reach. I think that was the name of the book, Targ and Puthoff. And the way Wikipedia trashes these guys, if you didn't know who they actually were, you would think, oh, these were lunatics, not physicists. I think they are physicists, and they enjoyed the confidence of, you know, tenured professors at university. Not all, but that's the way Wikipedia operates. The people behind the scenes, if you go to the page that is behind the page, you know, the debate about it, they trash anything that's paranormal or alternative medicine or whatever. You know, if you get a mainstream physicist who is, you know, not interested in the stuff that we're talking about, but just sticks to straight physics, they get nice reviews there. And they're not supposed to be reviews. It's supposed to be the online open source, which it isn't. But anyway, the things I've heard about Gray from people who were supposedly his friends, well, I knew his friends, his personal friends, and none of them had said anything negative about him. Mm. The real problem some people had was because they were homophobic and he was gay.
So
fucking what? I mean, he died of AIDS. So
right.
He was a boy fancier, but so was Jim Randi, the Amazing Randi. And it's not something that resonates today the way that it did back in the day. But it people would not just say, oh, he was queer, so therefore, blah, 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 blah. It was, you know, oh, well, he was, he didn't know what he was doing. He lied, blah, blah, blah. And I can find myself, I mean, I knew Randi, I knew Gray, I knew Jim, I knew their lives as they lived them. And they were properly dedicated to their craft. This will not take very long, but it's one
thing
that shows you why I think that reality is, as a whole, is malleable. I have good sound physics reasons for believing that too. It's somewhat alternative, but not as much as it was before this year's Nobel Awards were given, quantum physics, because quantum physics from a determinist rational point of view is insane. I mean, the things that you can say about it are insane.
Yeah.
But that doesn't mean they're not true. They are just as true as the more conventional things, but maybe more so. So one occasion convinced me how plastic reality is before I, really fully appreciated, as most ufologists do not, the implications of quantum physics and what I think is going to be the next stage, quantum biology. Look out, Richard Dawkins. Look out. So, on one occasion, and this happened when Jim was living in New York, and he proceeds to get really, really, really drunk. Really drunk. I'm going to call a random police department in New Jersey and say there's a flying saucer hovering over their headquarters. So he looks on a map or something and picks Wanakee, New Jersey. And he said, I'm going to say it was over the reservoir. There's a reservoir. So he calls the Wanakee, New Jersey Police Department, because he was able to straighten his voice out. He was lifelong drunk, so he was, that's right, officer, I'm so glad to see you. I just saw a UFO, a flying saucer, over the reservoir. Get everybody out there. It's quick. And that set off a genuine flap where the cases check out. It's known as the Wanakee Reservoir Flap. Look it up. It's probably on Google.
So even though the initial report was a hoax, then that kicked off the whole...
I don't think there are any hoaxes.
So, Alan, something that I wanted to ask you, a lot of the stuff that I've read over the past 6 months or so, whether it be to do with the ultra-terrestrial theory, cryptids, John C. Lilly and his flotation tank experiences, synchronicity, all of this stuff, to me, very much kind of lends itself to the idea of simulation theory and the idea that we're living in a simulation. What are your thoughts on that?
Gaming is simulation, but it's simulation of our world. I mean, there's even a thing called Second Life, and I know people who live that more than they live their actual biological life. So if you're asking, is one of the possibilities that we're living in a simulation? Possibly, but that's an almost unknowable one. What we can know is that if we accept the full implications of quantum mechanics, and in specific, one of the several theories around the many worlds interpretation of quantum mechanics, which I tend to buy, or the just M theory that has a specific number of realities, that there is a paper thin wall between these realities, which current physics says is impenetrable, but then physics just, well, still some physicists, but I think quantum theory has prevailed in the last 20 years, slowly but surely. It was, the whole idea of quantum phenomena was, how shall I put it, disagreeable to them. Even Einstein and his famous spooky action at a distance quote, which is overused, but I think his initial thought was, oh no, this throws everything into disarray. And what was it, the other expression? God does not play dice with the universe, which basically quantum mechanics is random throws of the dice. I find that more accessible because the next phase is most likely going to be something along the lines of how to interpenetrate realities. There, I don't have any real, I mean, if you wanted me to do the math on that, I couldn't, because I don't think anybody has. Michio Kaku comes close to that, but it's like in the far future, we will figure out how to escape from the universe into other universes by whatever he says, but it's not, you know, it's not a theory, it's a speculation. But I am also, I have many hats, and one of my hats is I'm a pretty fair ceremonial magician. And I do, or have done, is more like it, Enochian magic, including the calls of the 30 ethers and the open portals there to somewhere else through magical intent. I've done it with a room full of people. Weird things happen. The lights go out. The lights in the whole neighborhood go out. Entities come through and wander around. It's sort of like a seance, which I think is probably what seances are. But it's under the control, or at least under the tutelage of the magician. I wouldn't do that with a group of people until I had attained a certain level of magical prowess. And one of the things, one of my great arguments is you must teach banishing before you teach invoking or evoking, because it's a lot easier to invoke or evoke than to banish. And when I reached that point, at that time, I was a lodge master at the OTO. And we had it fully set up according to Dr. D's description of it. And I think D and Kelly were a fortuitous combination. Kelly was a crook. He was a Gray Barker type. He was a Monty and a magician and I think a magus. And when you have all four of the permutations of the tarot card, which dates from, that one dates from the Renaissance, you probably are onto something important. And from my experience with working with Enochia, opening portals is something that you can do through technomagic, I guess you would call it. I can't remember the name of the series, but there was a term used that I liked, technomage. These were people who, basically, they were following Arthur Clarke's dictum that a truly advanced technology would be indistinguishable from magic. And truly advanced magic would be indistinguishable from technology.
One of the things that we were going to ask about, which I was hoping we could go into on here, is that like we'd like to give our listeners an idea of how they can use the cipher. You know, and we can then get into talking as well about your obviously the cipher and the secret rituals, you know, the complete cipher, but then also you've got your new one coming as well, which we're really keen to talk about. I wanted to sort of start getting into talking about the cipher by talking about synchronicity, which is your kind of unofficial catchphrase since Hellier. And episode 7 of series 2 of Hellier, I think, is a turning point in the series, really, when you give the guidance and what you say to them is follow the synchronicities, which is something.
Said, don't try this at home.
Well, yes. Now, I listened to half of what you said because I have started to a magical practice of my own since watching Hellier. And the first thing that I noticed when I started practicing magic was synchronicity just springing up, you know. And my personal thought on it is that you know, these synchronicities are there all the time happening, and the first thing that you do when you start doing magic is you start to notice them, and then when you notice them that you see more and more and more. And I wondered if you could speak to whether in your experience as a magician, whether magic is basically pure synchronicity, you know, like the control of synchronicity or the mastery of synchronicity or the encouragement of synchronicity in some way.
Oh boy, that's a really, really good question that I probably don't know, because when the magic works, is it because of what the magician does, or is there a synchronicity between the magician's intent and something happening? I mean, Jung was, I guess, the first modern person to propound the notion of synchronicity and probably came up with the term religion. But he gives us an illustration. He was with a patient, and I mean, I'm probably garbling the story a little bit because it's been a long time since I read it, but he's with a patient, and the patient is saying, I have, I see scarab beetles from Egypt in my dreams. And he says, really? Well, that's this is Thistle, which is not known for its scarab beetles. A scarab beetle comes up to the window and hits the window at that moment. That's a synchronicity. Now, did the patient invoke that? Did Jung, who I think had quite a handle on synchronicity since he invented the term, did he invoke it? Or was it simply a matter of coinciding in a meaningful way, which is the definition of synchronicity? It's probably not possible to know that, but it is possible to say, if I didn't do the ritual, it wouldn't have happened. You know, what's cause and what's effect, I don't think those terms would be around 2 centuries from now.
Because when I use the cipher, which I have been using the cipher a bit for the last few months, and when I use the cipher, what I feel when I'm doing it is something similar to what I feel when I'm doing the I Ching or pendulum divination, like that there's some other element, which I think comes down to what you call the noise to signal ratio, which I think you need to use an element of, I think, possibly magical discretion in order to amp up the signal and take the noise down. And so that to me indicates that the cipher itself is some sort of magical working in itself, like a small magical ritual of divination. Do you agree with that?
Absolutely. In fact, you're the first other person other than myself that has seen it that way. I think there's something implicit in the universe that, I mean, this is basic chaos theory 101, but the notion that the microcosm reflects the macrocosm because they are causally causally. It's late at night here, people. And it's cold outside, and the window is radiating the cold, and there's a mouthman at my window. That's the usual way things are here in sunny Atlanta. So, you have things like the Fibonacci sequence of numbers, and in turn, that closely resembles the whirlpool in your tub when you empty it, or the way galaxies tend to look like pinwheels, or the way pinwheels tend to look like galaxies. One time, my student advisor in Tucson, he came over because I had a early reel-to-reel videotape system. And he said, let's point this camera at the TV and see what happens. I said, okay, sounds good. But I didn't expect what did happen, which was an interference pattern. It looked like a circling swastika. And I thought, so that's where this symbolism comes from, that it's an inherent interference pattern that at a certain angle, if you create that interference, it's going to form a pattern that has existed in various cultures since the dawn of time.
So I've been using the cipher to sort of run sort of various things through it as a means of divination, basically, to sort of find the connections between things, to find the next thing. So obviously one that we've covered already is the word vase itself, which came to me in a dream that Buckley was in. And obviously vase is 56 in the cipher, 5 and 6 is 11, which is magical and significant to the cipher, because that's the cipher keys, is increments of 11, isn't it, as mm-hmm. you go through the library. It also comes up with the words way in, which it was my way into magic and so on, wise, which it has brought me wisdom, fear, it's brought me a lot of fear in the bits and pieces that I've done, and it also all I can as well, which is sort of personal, in vase. Then I tried putting each of our names as three through it for this interview. I'm not going to go into that, because obviously the Book of Lore is full of horrible things. So every time you put someone's name into it, you just get a list of, like, if you put my name in, you get Peter C. Hine, Caress of Hell's Own Worm, which is sort of not a sort of particularly flattering thing for Aleister Crowley to say about me. But what it does do is 191 is my cipher value, which is also 11, which is the same as vase. And also 191 is the great god Pan. And for people who've listened to this podcast before, they'll know about my bizarre and terrifying encounters with the great god Pan on the solstice. So instead of putting our names through, instead, because there would be no vase without you, Alan, and there would be no vase without the cipher, I put the cipher into the cipher. So I put the secret cipher of the Euphonauts into the cipher to see what would come out. And I got a value of 441, which is, there is a factor infinite and unknown and all. Then it says, appeal to my writings, each for himself. Then it says, me, for there is a further secret, I, which suggests to me in researching this, Alan, that there might be a further code or secret or cipher or system of synchronicities running through the actual book itself.
That's possible. I mean, I haven't, you know, there are people that have experimented with the Star 26 module of Lexicon, which drew all the attempts that could be made having the English alphabet in a circle and attempting to draw without crossing the same line. And I really wish I still had that available, because what it does is, if you put the Star 26 module in there, the sixth permutation is the first one that is successful. So Cipher 6 is the English Kabbalah as conveyed in the grid page in the Ramal. But there are maybe an infinite number or a finite, very, very large number of other successful ciphers that could be drawn. And if you simply let it run, you would see, I think there is so much there. I've never gone beyond that first successful cipher. There are people who wanted to work with alternative ciphers. At least I hope people down the line will work with alternative ciphers. And what you're suggesting is essentially there may be ciphers within ciphers. I don't doubt it. When I have people that are more or less students of mine do scrying, I let them use any book, especially people that manually, decode what they're using. And this guy said, well, I can pick any book, thinking he would pick one of the Crowley Class A books, which is what people usually did in the Linux circles, which is not where I'm at now, but he said, well, I'm going to use Ulysses. Well, there's a novel that probably will not come up with any good. He came up with great results. Great results.
Yeah.
Well, there's a difficult, Boyce is a difficult writer, and that's a difficult book. But he was getting good material, and he obviously was into fancy literature. So, I grew up on Heinlein and Bill K. Dick, so they're not considered the same level of literary work. But the point is, you can, if what you were saying is right, and that we live in a universe that has an implicit code, if you will, then various permutations of that code must be there. You could come up with something, which is why I think it's very difficult to call a hoax per se. It's like inspired at that moment to create a fake UFO photo or whatever. I don't do that because I do have some misgivings about that.
You just need something to kind of kick it off, really, So that could be like Jim Moseley with his hoax, or it could be any book, really, as long as you're coming at it with a magical intention.
So something that we'd actually noticed about the book itself, the sort of layout of the book itself, is that there are certain words throughout the complete secret cipher which are split into two words. So, for instance, on page 43... the word demonstrated is split like demonstrated, as if it's two words. Now, what we wondered was, is there some kind of code hidden within the book? Is there something to these split words that perhaps needs to be deciphered by avid readers like us? Or, alternatively, are we just looking for patterns where there are no patterns?
No, it's a computer error that the proofreader didn't. Well, it's machine generated. That doesn't make it an error, but it's not the way. If by error I mean the way I want the book to be printed, which is all the words spell right. And I often say I write them, but I'm a horrible editor. I'm not a proofreader at all.
Yeah, I think that was perhaps just me looking for patterns where there wasn't any. But
maybe it does mean something. I mean, they don't show up in the same places. And I use the I Ching as well. And I have contemplated long and hard on why does it work? Because it does. Better than the tarot, actually.
Yeah.
For years, I don't do it anymore. I kept a record of how, to the extent that I know what my readings, whether they turn out or not. I have about 85% on tarot, but it's closer to 100%.
Yeah.
In the I Ching.
Yeah.
It's less personal, but it does involve randomization, especially if you do, as I do, use the Aristotle method, which is slow, which is tedious, which takes a long time. But the fact is that you are really doing randomization, and the only thing that would be more random would be a random number generator, and I don't have one of those. But randomness is a tricky thing. It's not disorder. It seems to freeze the moment. And that's what the issue does. By the time you have, you know, created all six lines of the hexagram,
Okay, so this has been absolutely incredible so far, but we still have so much that we want to talk to you about, Alan. But just keeping an eye on the time, and we've got a lot of ground still to cover. So to make sure that we do this interview justice, I think that we're going to make this a two-part episode and split it here. So I'll link to all the places that you can find Alan in the show notes. You can find us at www.vaes.co.uk or on Twitter and Instagram at VAYSEESYAV. You can get us on Mastodon at vaes@home.social, and you can email us at vaesinfo@gmail.com. And if you'd like to download the excellent soundtrack to the podcast, you can do so at vaes.bandcamp.com. So join us next time when we'll be continuing to explore the fascinating mind of Dr. Alan Greenfield.
Vaes is the place where you ought to be, but I'm trying to see. Guys
getting fired now from your jobs, because
it probably is what, let's see what time is it there? Don't tell me. 11:38 a.m.
Yeah, but it's Sunday for us.
It's Sunday for me too, but I'm not taking out the trash tonight. Because I'm not.